Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Good evening. Thanks for being with us on this crisp, chilly beginning of fall day here in New England. Everything changes really quickly, and we're going to be talking about, talking about one of those changes with our guest tonight, Deona Kelly Said, who's been here before, but she has a new book, and we will continue talking about our topic of ghost hunting. But first, tonight's metaphysical musing, which, of course, should be about ghosts, one would think. And why is everybody so fascinated with ghosts? I mean, what's the big deal here? And what are we really what kind of information are we really looking for? And in the most basic way, the phenomenon of ghosts and confirming for yourself whether or not ghosts are real is answering that question of what happens after you die. And this is a conversation that's been going on since the dawn of time, and every indigenous culture has their way of looking at what that other existence is about, talking about the spirit world, talking about communicating with ancestors, a very rich part of all indigenous cultures. And then we get to, you know, science and to a certain extent the church and the more modern religions and their opinions getting involved, and all of that kind of changed. And now here we are in a new time with a new focus and technology and all kinds of ways to look at this. And we're trying to figure out, to confirm whether or not there's life after death, whether ghosts are real. So what are the scientific things? What are the things that we know so far about whether ghosts might be real, or at least whether some part of us goes on after the physical part of us no longer works? And that's basically what it is. I mean, when somebody is alive, the body is animated, there's a personality there. And when somebody dies, whatever that is no longer there. And the question is, what is that something that makes you alive? And does that have its own existence? Does that exist before and after you have this physical body? Well, at the turn of the 19th century, late 1800s, I think it was, might be the early 1900s, which is a time of very basic technology, somebody did experiments measuring whether the human body changed weight when a person died. So people are born on an in-breath and they die on an exhale. The body gives a deep sigh. And at that moment, it turns out, even with the very simple measuring technology that they had back then, they discovered that the human body is slightly lighter right after that sigh. And there were no apparent physical reasons for it. They checked all the possible things that could have escaped from the body in that moment, and there really isn't anything. The body is a little less than an ounce lighter right after that last breath. Well, that kind of smacks of something leaving the body. And then there's that pesky second law. I think it's the second law. If it isn't, someone will correct me. Second law of thermodynamics, which says energy cannot be created or destroyed. It can only change form. And clearly, whatever it is that animates us, whatever is our personality, is a form of energy, because everything is energy. Quantum physics is showing us more and more and more that they don't know how this illusion of there being solid matter is being created. That's why they're so excited about the Higgs boson. But even that particle that they're looking for now, that's supposed to tell us more about what matter really is and how it even is here, they're talking about an energy field which gives that whatever matter is to the Higgs boson. They're still talking about energy. So it makes some kind of sense in quantum physics to say that there's that everything is energy and only a part of that energy appears to be solid. And for some period of time, whatever our energy is occupies this physical body, whatever physicality means. It gets really complicated when you start thinking about this stuff and reading about this stuff. And even more so if you study the beliefs and teachings of ancient indigenous cultures and even some of the modern religions. So here we are in a more modern day where lots and lots of people are ghost hunting. And they're looking for ways to either debunk or confirm other people's experience of what could be ghosts, what could be some phenomenon of somebody that used to be alive but doesn't have a body anymore, but seems to be affecting the people that do have bodies. And that's a really interesting question, and that's our metaphysical musing and also the introduction to my wonderful guest, Deanna Kelly Said, who is with us. You're right there, Deanna?
I'm still here.
And your new book is So You Want to Hunt Ghosts, A Down-to-Earth Guide. And since I'm a punster, I love that.
I'm glad you do.
So welcome and thank you. I just had a day or so to look through the book. It's great. It's very interesting stuff. And it's kind of the follow-up to the book that you wrote that was published about a year ago, mm-hmm. Paranormal Obsession, America's Fascination with Ghosts, Hauntings, Spooks, and Spirits, which we had a lot of fun with. So I don't know how you would like to start the conversation, but it might be fun to kind of look at why you wrote the first book and what you were looking at there. And this seems to me, the second book seems to me to be the perfect follow-up to that first book.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate it. And I appreciate you taking time to look through my book and so quickly. As you mentioned, the first book I wrote, Paranormal Obsession, America's Fascination with Ghosts and Haunting Spooks and Spirits, really looks at why something like paranormal reality TV has become so popular in American society and why so many people have responded to these shows by becoming paranormal investigators. I don't like to use the word ghost hunter, but I mean, I know that's pop culture lexicon and people recognize that, but we're really not hunting ghosts. We're not into like hunting and trapping.
Right.
But people know what you mean when you say that. It's a cultural marker, so sometimes we have to use it. But the first book, I wanted to look at what these shows say about American society, what this recent incarnation of delving into the ghost frontier, what kind of commentary does that offer about who we are at this particular historical moment. And what I suggest in the book is that it really is one way for us to develop a new language about spirituality, a new language to talk about these really big issues that you mused about in the opening. But it also allows us to deconstruct how we talk about science and how we talk about personal experience. And it gives us a way to orient ourselves in a world that's increasingly globalized. And it also allows us to engage history in a very intimate way. I really wanted to look at why people are drawn to this. And we know that there's been cycles of this before during spiritualism and in other ways, but this was unique. This time is a little bit unique because it is global due to pop culture. And even during spiritualism, you didn't have what we have today. You didn't have so many people going into homes, into private homes, investigating this type of phenomena. And this is where the second book comes in, because we are at a moment where we have so many people, I mean, hundreds of thousands of people claiming to be ghost hunters and going into people's homes and historic sites and collecting data of strange things. There is a new ethical landscape emerging in all of this. And I wanted to look at these, the philosophy and the ethics behind it, but also use this as an opportunity to educate people who many have come in the last 10 years because of reality TV, and that's great. But the downside is they don't really understand or they don't know the long history of psychical research, parapsychology, and even occult studies on these things because they've learned everything from TV. And
right.
I wanted to expose people to the larger legacy so they understand that when they go out and do something, you know, it's probably been done before, and instead of reinventing the wheel, you can grab and delve into this previous literature, so when you go out, you're actually expanding the dialogue rather than just replicating everything that's happened before.
Right. And that's actually been part of what I've done, although I come at this not as a paranormal investigator, but as somebody who does remote healing frequently at buildings where there are paranormal phenomena. And it's like, well, lots of other people have done this. Do they find the same things as I do? Do they use the same methods? Do they have the same point of view? What do they notice about how it affects people? And that's really been fascinating. And there's literature from all over the world. One of my favorite books was written by a woman in Poland who's a psychotherapist as well as being psychic, and has worked with thousands and thousands of patients. She does a lot of exorcism and depossession of people, but she also works on land and buildings. And it's fascinating to read someone with that much background coming from a totally different culture, but also a totally different background, and find that they're saying the same things that I ran across and coming up with the same solutions.
It is interesting, and it affirms that in one way you may be doing metaphysical work, but there's real substance. There's for lack of a better term, there's almost like real sound methodology and perhaps quantitative or qualitative data that you can get from these things when you think about it in the right way. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Right. And that's, you know, people say, well, how do you know it's real? I say, well, I get results. But the other thing is that I know other people around the world who do similar work remotely, because I work mostly remotely, and we've checked for each other. I've said, okay, this building at this time, tell me what you find before I worked on it and what you find after, and their notes and my notes match.
And we've
done it over and over again. So it's the level of science at which you start having consistent anecdotal data, which is still anecdotal. It's not experimental. But until you have technology that actually can isolate and measure something that you can create an experiment with, all you ever have is anecdotal data. That's how all science starts.
Exactly. And that's one thing I talk about in the book. We have to start better documenting the data we are collecting. We may not exactly know what we're capturing, but when we write our reports and save our data and all of that, we need to start thinking about ways to present it and to preserve it. So all of these thousands of people who are doing ghost hunting on Saturday night, 100 years from now, is it all going to be lost?
Right.
Or can we start creating at least a segment of the community, start creating documentation so we create some sort of archive database for the future?
Yep. And it would be wonderful to have some kind of consistency in data collection and some place to send it.
It would be. That is a discussion that a segment of the paranormal investigative community they're having. One of the problems is some people say, well, we don't want standards because we don't really know what we're dealing with, and we don't want people not to be creative. And if we start adhering to a certain protocol and methodology and standards, then we may miss opportunities to really find answers. And I guess that's a valid point. But what I argue for in the book is that we have people who may volunteer on certain cases to follow a certain protocol or have one site that certain groups can come in and they agree to follow a protocol when they're at that site. So you don't have to follow standards every time you go out, but at least volunteer to do so on certain projects. So everybody can collect data from one site, for example, following similar methodologies, and see what happens. I mean, it's just...
Well, there's also just a consistency in recording what the what was found. So did they get any result with the methods that they used, even though the methods may not be totally consistent? You know, EVP, getting a response on EVP is getting a response on EVP. We heard something, it was a voice, is a validation that could be recorded.
Yes,
Yes. And there's nothing quite like the drama of hearing something on EVP or seeing something move on an infrared camera.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing when you experience this, and it's the event itself is great and sometimes completely transformative, but you need to write it down so it's not just a story. You need to document it. And you never know. You document it and you find out that 20 other people in the past 5 years have experienced the same thing independent, and that's when it becomes actual data.
Right. Right, and it's when it gets past being an excuse to have a personal experience.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things for me, I have people come to me and say they want to apprentice and things, and one of the things I ask them is, if an object moved in front of you unexpectedly for no apparent reason, what would your response be? And if their response is, I'd freak out. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, you're not ready for the next level.
Yeah.
You know, you have to, for what I'm doing, that has to be, oh, that's interesting. Why'd you do that? Mm-hmm. You know, just nonplussed by the fact that somebody's there and they're doing something. That's what you expect.
Yeah.
And I know, especially on the TV shows, at least early on, I can't watch them anymore because I sit in my living room alone yelling at them. What are you doing? What are you doing? Are you crazy? Yeah, because they do some things that I consider to be incredibly unsafe, or at least the early shows did. I don't know what's going on now. But on the few occasions when somebody does feel something touch them or see an object move, that's the major dramatic event. And I hope at some point people will get to the level where it's just the beginning of a conversation.
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. I think people aren't asking those questions about the mechanisms behind the event. They just want to experience the event itself. And I talk about that a little bit in the book. You know, if that's what you want to do, that's great. That's fine. Just be open about it. And please don't go into private homes and try to solve problems for families. You know, that's not your role in this. You have a different role.
Right.
And unfortunately, we do see that happening, people going into private homes and acting irresponsibly and unethically in some cases.
Right. Well, the problem with amateurs in any field is they have a lot of amateur means from the heart, and they have a lot of emotion and desire to do what they're doing, but don't necessarily have that sense of how they're affecting the other people involved and what the ethics are. And I saw this in the early days of ambulance and rescue decades ago, before EMT and paramedic were standardized and all the rest of the things, and people would do and say things in people's homes that had tremendous effects on what the family expected, and sometimes on the outcome for the patient, having no idea that there was anything wrong with it. They just were clueless. They were never exposed to the idea of professional standards or ethics or those kinds of issues. And as a field matures and becomes professionalized, you start getting that.
Well, one would hope, you know, and that's one of the goals I have for this second book, is people start to talk about, have a public dialogue around how our own personal philosophies impact the way we investigate, because a lot of people never really think about what they believe.
Right.
And a call to ethics, doing no harm. And also, if you claim to do science, and you don't have to do science, because there's many different ways one can contribute to this field, but then think like a scientist, and I offer ways to to do research and design projects on your investigation, because just going out and doing a whole night of EVP work is, there's more to it than that. And a lot of people never get beyond that. And that's one thing I want people to think about. You know, how can you scientifically use psychics and sensitives and mediums, and how can you make it useful for yourself so you're actually contributing to the discussion rather than just replicating what you see on TV?
Right. Because I know part of my frustration is I can provide information on what may be going on and where things are happening within a building, which could really help the investigation and confirm or not my sensibility of what's happening. And a lot of the paranormal community just turns their noses up at that and thinks it's all crazy and bunk. And there's history behind that. There were and probably still are lots of charlatans. So there are always people that will say, oh, that stuff can't possibly be true. But my challenge to them would be, okay, let's work together and see whether it is.
Yeah, very true. Yeah, we can't discard one form of knowledge totally and then rely completely on technical attributes to answer these questions. And my own personal opinion, I really like the consciousness model for a lot of what we may be experiencing and what people call ghosts. I feel very comfortable suggesting that consciousness plays a large role in this and pulling in through quantum mechanics and quantum consciousness. Not everyone likes that idea.
Right.
I personally like it, and I can't prove that that's the answer to all of this, but I find that it makes sense both metaphysically and scientifically. But we don't yet have any way to really prove that we're dealing with something called disembodied consciousness.
Well, you know, part of my perspective is if you look at the recorded history of indigenous cultures, which goes back especially into Egypt and Persia and a lot of the Middle East, goes back 9,000 years. And they're very clear that this stuff is real and that they're interacting with it.
Mm-hmm.
So either everybody was delusional in exactly the same way in every culture on the planet for thousands and thousands of years, or something is going on that's been reported consistently for all that time by people in completely diverse historical times in different cultures with different spiritual sensibilities and different religions, and they still came up with the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my starting point, is obviously to me something is going on. Everybody has always known about it, but for some reason in the last 1,500 years or so, we've decided it's not real. So I kind of flip it on its side and go, no, everybody else was right, and science just separated themselves from, you know, it was, there was actually a historical point at which the church and science decided who got what part of the conversation.
Yeah. Exactly.
And the church would stop considering scientists heretics.
Mm-hmm.
So it behooves science not to step over the boundary.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting you brought that up, because I think in a very small way, one thing that people do who go out into the ghost frontier, and we are, in a way, bringing the metaphysical, the science, and the spirit back to a point where they can talk to one another. And I would say it's a very crude type of discussion sometimes, but it's allowing us to ask questions on how these two overlap. I mean, people who are thinking along these lines are able to start asking questions on how these overlap and what they mean in terms of our own human experience and what it means metaphysically, and hopefully what it may mean scientifically at some point.
Right.
You talked about weighing the soul, and it's so funny you started with that, because the study you're talking about is MacDougall. He did this study on dying patients, and he claimed that they did lose something like an ounce when they died. Now, there's somebody else who did a more contemporary study on animals, goats, I think, of all things. I don't exactly know what conditions the animals passed away in, but I think when he measured it, animals actually gained weight.
Interesting.
That is interesting. And we don't, I
very
mean,
interesting.
Very different time and probably different methods and different technology used. Right. Now, the Ryan Research Center, which is the former Duke Parapsychology Lab, they're starting a new experiment where they're going to try to weigh the soul. They call it weighing the soul, but it's not really that. They're going to weigh people who are trained to do out-of-body experiences.
Ooh.
And see what happens during controlled OBEs. And I've seen the lab, and I've seen the scale, and they're just starting to experiment with this. But I think that's going to be very interesting to see what they come out with over the next couple of years.
Tiana, I'm going to have to interrupt you because we're going to have to go to the break. I want you to give your website very quickly.
It's DeonnaKellySayed.com. It's S-A-Y-E-D is the last name, .com.
Terrific. We will give you several more chances to do that, hopefully. And we will also be giving people an opportunity to call in and join the conversation. I'll give that phone number as soon as we come back from our short break here on the Farkas Files on Empower Radio. Stay with us. Come on back.
Lost a cat? And have you ever wanted to get your cat back after you lost it? I'm Andrew Hoffman. I invented the lost cat magnet. Just turn it on and lost cats stick to it. Just listen to one satisfied cat. That's proof. You should invent stuff too. But remember, don't do a lost cat magnet.
Anything's possible. Keep thinking. Get started on your own inventions or just play some games at inventnow.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
My sport is football, but my passion is education. My name is Nnamdi Asamoah, and this is how I live United. I see too many kids miss out on moving up. Kids who could go on to college, but just need that extra little push. So every year, I take promising high school students on a college tour. We check out the dorms, the library, meet some professors, find out where the best late night grub stops are. It shows them that there's a whole world beyond their own. But what's even better is that most of these kids decide college is for them. I'm Nnamdi Asamoah. I show kids that a higher education means a brighter future. So when it comes to living United, I don't just wear the shirt. I live it. Join me.
It takes all of us working together to make a difference. Find out how you can live United for Education. Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Sassy!
This week's episode, Rattlesnake at the Pond.
Oh, Johnny, skipping rocks at the pond sure is fun.
Hey, look, a moving stick.
That ain't a stick, that's a rattlesnake.
Sassy, we're in danger.
Good idea, Sassy. Go get Mr. Gunderson. You will in a second, but first you'd like to tell us something we may not know about animal shelters in the United States?
It's getting close, Sassy!
Approximately 8 million pets enter shelters each year? The majority of which are in shelters because of owner-related issues that the animals have no control over?
Sassy, the rattlesnake! Save us, Sassy!
What, Sassy? You wish you were videotaping this? Sassy!
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
Now back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back with my wonderful guest, Deanna Kelly Said. And we're going to continue our conversation, but I want to give you, in the listening audience, a chance to join the conversation. And you can do that by calling 248-809-3475. 248-809-3475. Give us a call, join the conversation, ask questions, have some fun. So, Deanna, you were just kind of teasing me there with the Duke Paranormal Lab stuff, and I'm, you know, my ears perked up inside my headset here.
Well, the Ryan Research Center, that's what it's now called, they are doing some really fascinating stuff. And J.B. Ryan, who established the Duke Parapsychology Lab, wasn't very interested in survivor research. That was his initial interest. But because you can't bring a ghost into the lab, you had to study the mechanisms we have to experience consciousness. So he started studying mediums and psychics, which led to studying ESP and then telekinesis and remote viewing and all of these things that might be related to psi, the concept of psi.
Right.
So ghost hunting is a very small part of what they do. But it's really fascinating some of the things that they're doing now. And I mentioned the Weigh in the Soul experiment, which will be weighing people who can do out-of-body experiences. But they also have a lab where they measure, I believe, light emissions. I think it's ultraviolet light emissions from healers and people who do martial arts, and people who can manipulate chi or psi.
Right.
And they have found there is a marked difference between people who have that ability and people who don't yet know how to do it. There is an incredible difference, which is fascinating because this is hard data that demonstrates that something is going on when it comes to possibly psi.
Right, right. And there are a number of different approaches to that research. You must be familiar with Dean Radin's work.
Mm-hmm.
At the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and when he talks about the 100 scientists on the planet that are doing this kind of research. They're doing hard science about psi-related kinds of things, and only about half a dozen of them are in the United States.
Exactly. Yeah.
So both the amount of research, but also the exposure of that research to the scientific community is very small. It doesn't mean that the work is not being done and the information is not showing up. It just means most of it's not in English. It's in Russian.
Yeah.
It's in Russian and Chinese.
Yeah.
So we're very far behind in that. And the other thing that he mentions at every talk I've heard him do is that if he's speaking to an audience of scientists, they'll all sit there looking very dour with their arms crossed until they come up to talk to him after the conversation. And in private conversations, they're just chattering away about their experiences and how they can't even express their opinion about it without taking a chance on losing their livelihood, losing their grants.
True. Yeah, that's very true. I do know a few academics in the paranormal ghost hunting community, and that's true for them. I mean, they don't tell their colleagues what they do. So, unfortunately, the academic climate in the United States is not conducive for these types of discussions. But I think that will change. And one thing in my first book that I argued is now after 10 years of reality TV, people who have grown up watching this, they are now starting to become college students. And I've had a couple of these students actually contact me. They're starting to do papers on different aspects of this in their classes, mostly from sociology and anthropology and those areas. But as we see more people who have developed this interest in their academia, they'll start finding ways to incorporate this in their studies. So hopefully, if there's any benefit to all of this reality TV stuff, is that the people who were fans, those who would go to college and become academics, will start to pursue a legitimate way to ask questions around these topics.
Right. And one of my favorite paranormal shows was Paranormal State. I don't even know if it's still on.
No, it's
gone, isn't it? But they took a much broader approach to it, and it was very much a problem-solving approach. And they did the historical research, and they did the typical paranormal investigator activities, but they also brought in a medium if it seemed appropriate, and they used a very wide range of things, all with the focus of directly helping the family with whatever was distressing them. And the two things for me in all of this work that I think in many cases gets lost is, one, the reason that most people are doing it, unless they're going to an well-established haunted site where they pay a fee and they go and do it, there are people involved, and the reason that we should be doing this kind of stuff is to assist these people who are having a distressing experience and want to have some way of dealing with it, resolving it, at least understanding it. And frequently what an investigation will do is either say, yes, we found something, you're not crazy, or no, we didn't find anything, but that doesn't mean you're not crazy, that you're crazy. You know, it's like the information won't necessarily solve the problem that the family is having. But the other thing that doesn't seem to be part of the conversation, and it's totally part of my point of view, is we're dealing with human beings that we call ghosts who are lost souls. They're confused. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing what they're doing. I have a long, long point of view and perspective on it. But it's respecting our ancestors. It's helping our ancestors. These folks are there for some reason. They haven't crossed over. And what is all of this paranormal investigation doing for the ghosts? So all my work is about helping them cross over. Mm-hmm. The information to me is interesting and all that, but I'm not interested in the stories. I'm interested in the mechanisms that got them stuck, and I'm interested in helping them cross over. And there are frequently, in a place that's haunted, there are thousands of ghosts which will never interact. They're so much in their own experience, which is not in the physical world, that they will never interact with the living, but they're still stuck.
Mm-hmm. You bring up an interesting point, and that is a conversation a lot of people don't have. And I have found those who do have it often don't come from the type of invested background that you come from. They like the idea of helping something crossover, but they've never really read much about it or developed their own intuitive abilities in the appropriate way. It's almost like a romantic idea.
Yeah.
They don't really understand, as you said, the mechanisms that may keep something attached to a location or to a person or whatever. And I have, you know, we have someone in our group who is now working on these issues. He doesn't work on these issues in the context of our group, but he does as an individual. And his work is very fascinating. It actually, you know, when he first started talking about it, I'm like, I don't know if I'm comfortable with this. But when I see what he's doing, you know, I appreciate the perspective he's providing. And he's gone to the Monroe Institute and other places and really invested in learning about this.
Mm-hmm. But
it, you know, asking questions from a different angle is always important, and it's always insightful.
Well, and one of the things I love about what you're doing is you're really bringing an academic perspective and an academic way of studying things and expressing things to what's been pretty much the Wild West. You know, people just went out and did whatever they did and said whatever they said without really considering much. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate that you're giving it structure. You're making the kinds of assumptions that an academic makes and using that language to give this more stability, more structure, more and more respectability in many ways. Because as people start using that kind of a perspective and presenting things in that way, it won't be poo-pooed as much.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate the fact that you appreciate that. That really means a lot to me, because often people who do gravitate to this, and we have so many different types of people, and many wonderful people get involved in this avocation, but so many, unfortunately, don't know how to have that conversation just yet. And it gets a little frustrating at times.
Well, for non-academics, academics are off-putting.
Yes, well, that's a burden. You know, it's just my life burden. What can I do about it?
Well, you know, one of the things that you are doing is finding other people who have more of that background that are doing this work, so that you start creating a cadre, a core group of people that are doing it with a different perspective. But, you know, like so many hobbies, which is what ghost hunting, paranormal investigating is for most people that do it, it's just that. It's a pastime. It's a group activity. It attracts people who have an adventurous spirit and are curious, but don't necessarily have any background in research or science or anything else. So they kind of pick it up as they go along.
Mm-hmm, they do.
And it's a discipline. It's a point of view. It's a discipline. It's a way of being in the world. And the same, there's also the split between the people who are doing it from a spiritual perspective, who also may either not know or be resistant to science, and the people who want to do it from a scientific approach.
Yeah, and I talk about that a little bit in the book. I identify four different types of paranormal investigative mentalities, and there may be more. I just break it down into four, and I do mention the spiritual base and the science base and the adventure base and the client based. And most investigators and most teams probably have all of them at one time or another. You know, you kind of adapt case by case, but everyone has a core philosophy, and it is very interesting to see how methodologies and the questions we ask about what we're experiencing differs depending on what we believe about what we're experiencing.
Right, right. And, you know, from the scientific point of view, the observer effect is going to change everything. So I always love people that set out to debunk anything, because as you believe, so shall it be for you. They will create and attract things that confirm what their point of view is, and then walk away saying, see, I couldn't create it. I couldn't see it. It doesn't exist. And what's really true is it doesn't exist in their presence.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It just means that they couldn't have the experience.
Yeah. Well, you know, you talked a little bit about the people who come into this. It is a hobby, and it's fine. That's fine for it to be a hobby. But for a lot of people, this hobby, this moment when they go out to investigate, and it's the only moment in their lives that they really have a chance to ponder larger questions about their existence in the world. They may not be doing it through meditation or through traditional religious service, but through the act of investigating, that is what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things about this kind of stuff as you do it is it brings up more questions than answers.
Yes, but that's part of the life journey, isn't it?
Yeah, right, right. And one of the, again, my topic more than your topic, although you do talk about it in the book, one of the issues that comes up for me about paranormal investigations is safety, both spiritual safety and physical safety. I used to do ambulance and rescue, and a lot of what I saw on the TV shows anyway was just people being unprepared for the condition of the building they were going into in the dark, and not really having a plan of what they would do if things went badly wrong.
Yeah.
In addition to not having a sense of the spiritual protection issues. I've had a number of people referred to me that, you know, picked up, as I would say, schmuggies along the way in investigations or being in places that had a lot of things going on. And other than the fact that they started having problems in their lives or getting sick, they really were clueless that that's what it might be.
I think that's a discussion well worth having with the right people leading that discussion.
Sure, sure.
And that's one of the things I've found. People who often talk about that, and I don't mean any disrespect to anyone, you are very credible, and as I said, you've invested in this study, this discipline, but sometimes the people who have these discussions have not.
Mm-hmm.
So the advice that they're giving is just not really well-grounded or very intelligent.
Right. Well, yeah, a lot of people are inarticulate. One of the things you touch on briefly in the book is the darker side of investigation, and that while it's a conversation with a lot of contentiousness in the community about whether there are demons and elementals and other non-human, non-physical beings that you can interact with, people will run across that stuff, whether they believe in it or not. And there are some very serious situations, even with ghosts that just have violent personalities. They are who they were when they were alive. So if you go to, you know, a psych hospital with a locked unit in a psych hospital or a prison, or even a military installation where everybody there was trained to be violent and everybody there was trained to protect the place, and you show up and you're not one of their people, you could be in big trouble. And I know I found that out by clearing a psych hospital on site, one of the reasons I don't work on site anymore. And I got knocked against the wall and choked. It's like, oh, this is real, and I am in serious trouble at this moment.
Yeah, that had to be a very exhausting effort.
I was very fortunate to have a partner with me that was at the same level I was. Which we were still we were beginners, but we were good beginners at what we were doing. And she was able to make enough space that I was able to get out of the situation. But it was scary and exhausting.
Yeah,
so when, you know, the guys on Ghost Hunter say, I've never seen anybody get hurt on a ghost hunt, I'm like, all righty then. I don't know where you've gone, but the places I've gone.
Yeah, there's so many parts of this which, you know, to have a real full discussion about it would be fascinating. And I've always wanted to handpick certain people and go out on an investigation with them and to experiment with different methodologies to get the full investigative experience, because a lot of times we go out, we're kind of doing the same thing over and over again with the same people.
Right.
And it's a great bonding experience with our teammates, but we're not really expanding our own personal horizons when it comes to these things by working with someone like yourself or someone with a very different skill set. I think we get a little uncomfortable. Many people get uncomfortable with that suggestion.
Right. Well, you know, you also have I thought the direction you were going was creating a conversation between people with very different backgrounds and experience. And that would be pretty easy to set up. We could set that up as a conference call or a webinar where we all had video, could see each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be we should continue that conversation. We could do some interesting things because you know a lot of people doing this work.
Mm-hmm. I would love to. I would love to. It would be great to go out and do an investigation with just mediums and psychics, to just completely forget technology for a while and just go out and do a seance. I mean, something very different. And I mean, and there are parapsychologists who actually work with the seance concept in a very interesting way, not in the way that we think of it, but in a way that is used to empower the client, and they also use hypnosis, but they're trained to do it.
Right.
And
right.
We've never thought of using these things during an investigation because most people can't do it. Most people aren't trained to do it. Wouldn't even think of it, you know.
Right. And do it safely and as you mentioned so well in the book, ethically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to do it in a way that's certainly not going to hurt anybody and is going to benefit the people who typically have brought the investigators in because something is going on that is either frightening or confusing or in whatever way distressing them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, and for whatever it's worth, since I work remotely, I could be doing that with you over the phone or on Skype. On Skype. So I can participate in what you're doing at any point that seems appropriate.
Mm-hmm. I think that would be a very interesting thing to set up.
Well, many, many more conversations that we can have about this.
Yeah.
So what would you like to leave people? You have the new book, so you want to hunt ghosts, a down to earth guide.
Yeah.
You know, what's the nugget that you want people to know about this book?
Well, this book is for people who are doing this paranormal investigation or who watch the shows who really want to have a deeper understanding and deeper discussion about what this is all about. And that's what I want to give people, a historical perspective, how to manage your team and how to design your cases so you can take it to the next level. It's not the final discussion on this. It's not necessarily the best thing that's ever been produced about ghost hunting, because there's many people like Troy Taylor and others who have written wonderful books, and everyone should read them. This is just a more contemporary perspective commenting on where we are right now at this moment.
And I think a very important perspective, especially for people who have never considered issues like ethics or how to handle a case or all the various things that you mentioned in there, are things that aren't part of the conversation for a lot of groups. So we're getting close to the end here. I want to make sure people know how they can get in touch with you and how they can get the books.
Well, both books are available on Amazon and online, and they're available as, I think, Kindle and Nook, and they might be at your bookstore. You can definitely order it through your bookstore if they're not on the shelf. And if you want to know more about me, you can go to my website at deonnakellysayed.com. That's DeonnakelliSayed. And I am on Facebook and on Twitter at Deonna Kelly. So please join me. And I would love to hear, if you're reading the book, I would love to get feedback on it. And let me know what I've gotten right and let me know what I've missed.
Well, this seems to be part of a series that's going from one book to the other addressing issues, I totally expect that you will have more to tell us.
Well, we'll see. We'll see where I'm going as a writer. I'm not exactly sure yet, but we will see. And for people listening who will be in Mississippi, I will be in Greenville, Mississippi, the first weekend of October with the Delta Paranormal Project. And if you're in the area, please do come out. I will be lecturing and doing all other sorts of stuff while I'm there in the deep, deep South.
And you're also involved with Ghostville.com.
Yes, I am the editor of GhostVillage.com, which was founded by Jeff Belanger, who's a very prolific paranormal author. It's one of the oldest established internet sites on ghosts, and it's probably the most highly trafficked site on ghosts and ghost hunting. So everyone should check that out, ghostvillage.com, and submit your own stories and even submit feature articles if one wants. Everything ghostly.
Fantastic. So what's next for you? Do you know?
Oh, my gosh. That is such a loaded question. What's next? I'm not really sure. I'm now exploring different types of writing, non-paranormal writing. But in terms of paranormal stuff, I'm not really sure what's next.
Well, that's a good position to be in.
It is.
That's sometimes confusing and angst-ridden, but, you know, it's a wonderful place where the next thing is going to appear any second. Deonna, thanks
better.
So much. Right. Thanks so much for being on the show again, and I hope you will come back, and I'm sure you will have other things to bring, and we'll continue our conversation and see if we can set up some fun experiences which we can report back to people.
Oh, certainly. Well, thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. So if people are interested in what I do, you can go to househealing.com. And on the contact page, you'll find every conceivable kind of technology to contact me, including a link to my scheduling calendar. I do a 20-minute introductory, complimentary, no obligation session for people with a scan of the property or the person that you're concerned about, and we can see whether my work is appropriate for the situation. One of the things that's a whole lot of fun for what I do is I never have any idea what's going to happen with the next thing I do or, you know, the next person that shows up. It's always something new. Our guest next week is somebody who's been on before, Jeffrey Reed, who is absolutely fascinating to me because she's a horsewoman. She is somebody who mostly specializes in animals, but also counsels people through that relationship with animals. And she is just, as we say here in New England, wicked smart and a lot of fun. So I'm very curious what she's going to bring to us. So until next week, this is David Franklin Farkas for the Farkas Files. Truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio. We'll see you next week.